the upper half and the lower half of the dipole have two different resonant frequencies. Wouldn't matter. Tune the whole thing to the overall correct length, and you will be at the resonant frequency. Back to you, Barry.
Okay, so far I'm with you, and you know this thing sounds like it's going to work. I've been doing a lot of thinking here. Okay, now, I am going to use balance, and I'm not going to use 50 ohm current, I'm going to use 75 ohm current, but that's, you know, neither here nor there. Now, the physical spacing of the antennas is going to remain what it is. The coax that goes from the feed point to the phasing unit in the middle of the tower. If I said, I don't want to put that phasing unit in the middle of the tower, I want to put it at the bottom of the tower, I want to put it in the shack, as long as I kept all the feed lines the same length, would that fly?
Absolutely, positively. The length of the feed line back to the phasing harness, you're saying as long as they're the same length. If you are smart enough, they don't even have to be the same length. As long as you know what length they are, you can correct for that back at the feed point, the so-called hybrid assembly that feeds the signals to those four pieces of cable. So life will be simpler if you make them all the same length. Even that is not a requirement if you're smart enough. Thank you, Barry.
Yeah, I understand. And because the phasing system is a thing that I don't make, somebody else makes it, and it's all ready to go, what I would want to do, of course, not to modify the phasing harness, I would simply keep all the feed lines the same length. Now, the next thing is, because this is not a parasitic array, because it's a driven array, wouldn't that also mean that the actual length of the elements of the antennas, if they were a little off-resonant, it wouldn't be as critical, because the reason why they're acting as directors and reflectors and all that sort of stuff is because of their forced phase, which is being determined by the phasing harness. So if it was a parasitic array, the length would be far more critical. That's what I'm saying. Is that true?
Okay. When it comes to, let me compare this thing to a four-element Yagi. I can build a four-element Yagi with a driven element, a reflector, and two directors. I really got a driven element and three parasitic elements. I adjust the length of the parasitic element and the position of the parasitic element for two criteria. That is, I want each of those parasitic elements to have a certain amplitude of signal and a certain phase angle of signal in order for me to get the Yagi action and to get the forward directivity, and to get the front-to-back ratio, and so on. If you're smart enough, you could take four dipoles, stack them along the boom at the exact same position as the four elements of that Yagi, and you could feed all four elements. It would be an all-fed array. And if you're smart enough to feed the right amplitude and the right phase angle of those signals, those four elements, you would get the exact same gain pattern front to back, and there's a slim chance you would get even a little bit more performance, because with the all driven array, you've got one more variable, you've got one more knob in your hand. You now have complete control of amplitude and phase at each individual element. You probably could get a little bit more performance. That's the good news. The bad news is a complicated procedure. Most people who have ever built all-driven Yagis have ended up with lower performance, not greater performance, because they took a whole bunch of shortcuts. One, they either fed the same amplitude to all and diddled the phase, and number two, they didn't realize that there was cross-coupling between the elements, and therefore impedance matching to the elements is a real dog of a problem. They didn't solve that. So they had the wrong amplitudes, the wrong phases of the resultant radiation. If, for instance, I fed equal phase and equal power to all four elements of my all-driven array, common sense would lead you to believe all four would end up with the exact same signal. Uh-uh. The because of the cross-coupling between the elements, even if I attempted to feed them all identical phase, there would be difference in phase. And correspondingly, if I fed, even if there was no cross-coupling between the elements, and I fed all elements the exact same phase of signal, if some of the elements were longer and shorter, they would still have leading and lagging phase angles because they're off-resonant. You can attempt to feed an antenna a particular phase angle of signal, but if that antenna is off-resonant and it's inductive or capacitive, if it's capacitive, it will have leading current, and if it's inductive, it will have lagging current, even though you think you're feeding them all in phase. So when it comes to real elements and the cross-coupling, life gets a little bit complicated. An all-driven array has the capability of being higher in performance, but because the average guy was not smart enough to solve all of those cross-coupling problems, different resonance problems, different amplitude problems, along with the different phase that he desired, because he didn't get that all together, he didn't get the performance he should have gotten. But the capability is there. The laws of physics tell him and me that if you're smart enough, all that performance is there. So in your case, the fact that you've got four elements where each one of the elements you think has a slightly different resonance on the upper half of the dipole and the lower half of the dipole, with the balance that goes away, you've got four independent feed points. There is some cross-coupling between the two, but if that phasing harness thing that you buy from Contact Systems is made of Contact, I think you called it Contact, C-O-N-T-E-C-T or something like that, if they've done the job correctly, all of that is taken into account. And by the way, this is a beautiful example of where computer modeling would help, or a lot of tweaking would help. The way Mel and I would build it is we would have four independent L-path, L networks. We would tune the four elements until the signal in a particular direction got stronger. So this sounds like a fun antenna. It would work very well on a road drive tower, but anything like a windjammer tower, which has got a wider base than the top, that's not going to work. You can see that problem, can't you, Barry? I'm having fun with you. NQFC, KQR, WFM.
Yeah, that was one of my next questions. You know what my tower looks like. Of course, the tower hopefully is completely non-resonant in this case. And therefore, it would probably, especially on 75 meters, which is unconfirmed, it shouldn't occupy too much space in the antenna. Do you agree with that? And also, that was another question, cross-coupling. The length of the coax going to these things, if it's all the same, there's another thing that comes into play here. I ran into this with Yagi. When the signal leaves the Yagi and goes back into the coax and it goes over to the other Yagi and it comes back, that length of that coax between the Yagi should make some sense to it. Should be a certain length, right?
In order to follow his design, you're absolutely right. To follow his design, there is a magic length. But if you are starting the design from scratch, you can choose any length of cable you want on all four of those cables, and then properly impedance match, phase shift, amplitude shift, and whatever, the four signals that you feed from the shack. So if you are starting from scratch, you could make that work. But when you're following his design, whatever number of wavelengths of cable he tells you to use exactly that number of wavelengths or an even number of wavelengths greater or less. If he told you to make it 3.5 wavelengths long, and you could make it 2.5 or 4.5, there's some chance you can move by half wave. Until I study it some more, the safe way would be to use one wavelength moving. So follow his design if you want his phasing harness to work correctly. Back to you, Barry.
Okay, I'll have to give him a call on that. I don't know how specific he was. There was some mention of it in a design. I'm going to get that design and I'm going to email it to you, the particular one in question that I saw. That was so nice. It's just some guy out in Oklahoma somewhere did it the way I'm telling you, the way I've mentioned it to you. This is not my idea. This is somebody else's idea. The guy says it works. But what I wanted to know from you, and I guess I got my answers ready, the fact that the elements are bent back to the point where they're almost touching each other, that isn't a tremendous disadvantage. Of course, it would be better if they were just vertical dipoles, and they didn't do that. If they didn't do that, I would have to be supporting them 60 feet away from my, or whatever, 50-something, 45 feet away from the tower. I can't do that in all directions. I'm going to wind up on somebody else's property. Now, the way I can do it, of course, is the way I've explained it, over.
Agreed. Now, the fact that they all come back to a common point on the top of the tower, on a very close to each other, is a minor phenomenon. In other words, in his particular design, if he did it with a Rhone 55 tower, and the tops of his four vertical Vs were all within 3 feet of each other, and because the top of your wind jammer is a little bit larger in diameter, therefore the tops of your four inverted Vs are going to be a little bit further apart. That implies you're going to have a little bit less close coupling than he had. I don't think that's a showstopper. If it is, you can correct it by putting a small amount of top hat wires, so to speak. You can make a little bit of a gimmick capacitor that makes your larger diameter wind jammer tower top have the exact same amount of cross coupling. You can correct for that. I don't think you have to go there. And maybe the top of your wind jammer is the exact same diameter as the top of his tower. The bottom of his tower also had a little bit cross coupling, and you're going to have a hell of a lot less because you've got a miniature Eiffel Tower there. You've got a lot more base separation. Again, I think these are second order effects. I don't think it's a showstopper. It's going to make a little bit of difference. And by putting a gimmick capacitor as a phase shifter in the phasing harness box in the shack, you can correct for all this. You're eventually going to put a couple of gimmick capacitors in or around that box in the shack, and you're going to operate those variable capacitors in order to pick up the signal when you're receiving. Because of the laws of reciprocity, most of the time, when you peak on receiving, you'll be peaking on transmitting. The reason I said most of the time is there is some Faraday rotation of the ionosphere, but you know about that. Sounds like a fun antenna. What's the name of this thing, and then what's the call letters of the guy in Oklahoma that invented it? N2MB, K2RIW, and the ZECNET.
Okay, I am going to find that before I give up on this tonight. Let me just see if I can get into that. Something in pictures, okay. I think I have a place here where I stored some of that information on my computer, which I just fixed. Yes, I found it. Okay. Anyway, I'll get to that in a second. But what I do want to do here, let me just get into this. Okay, yeah, I'm in it. Very good. The guy that did this is W7DD. That's the guy that did it. He had a little more to work with than I could. His tower is taller. It makes things a lot easier. But anyway, aside from that, what I'm going to do with the bottom of my antenna is I'm not going to attach it to the tower, you know, or because the tower is a triangle. It isn't square. It would be kind of hard to do that. I'm just going to put a post right under the tower, in the middle, under the tower, bring the wires right into a wooden post right there with insulators. So they're really going to be about the same distance apart at the bottom as they are at the top. The only difference is they're going to be sticking their noses underneath my tower for 2 or 3 feet.
No problem. That should work like a charm. On top of that, you could put the post in the dead center, symmetrical middle of the tower, on the concrete, so to speak. You could then run a rope or wire out to an insulator some number of feet from the post, then the insulator begins the wire of the dipole. So the fact that your wire penetrates your tower, absolutely no effect. Your tower is not a resonant structure. It's not enough of a shield on that end. The presence of the tower is going to add a little bit of capacitance to the lower half of the dipole, which brings it a little bit off of resonance. No problem, your balun takes care of that. And yes, if you want to, you can readjust the wire lens accordingly. No, that's going to fly. That's not a showstopper, Barry. Those are minor details. But by way of you spacing the insulators out from the post a little bit, you can simulate the exact base diameter of his tower versus the apparent base diameter of your tower. Except for the little bit of the capacitance you're going to have with your wire penetrating the tower, except for that, you're going to have his set up exactly. Back to you, Barry.
Okay, and here's the part you're probably not going to like. I know this one's not going to sit well. The place on my tower where I can affect, because I have the antennas on top of the tower, so I can't go all the way up to the top. Besides that, that part rotates. I can go about 75 feet. I'm supposed to have about 80-something feet, so I'm a little shy. And that means I could do one of two things. I could push the antennas out a little further and eat up some of that wire, or I could, my other plan is to put a little bit of loading coil on both ends to make those wires just some little bit shorter so that I can do this. And what do you think of that?
Okay. When you put up the very first vertical dipole, you're going to be tuning it before you put up the other three. By tuning it, I mean you're going to be adjusting the lens and or you're going to be putting a shunt capacitor across the feed point of the dipole. When you go to WA1MDA, Whiskey Alpha 1, Mike Bravo Alpha, you go .com, and you go to the bottom of his website, you'll see a section on dipole impedance matching. And when you open up that section, you'll see an article by K2RIW. When you read that article and understand it, you will be able to make each one of your dipoles a 1-to-1 standing wave ratio. And it doesn't matter if you use 35 ohm, 50 ohm, 70 ohm, or 300 ohm cable. You will be able to, with that article, to make each one of your dipoles an exact impedance match. There's some slight advantage if you do that. Life becomes easier. Your phase matching back box now will be looking into four dipoles that give you no individual viswas on their individual cables. That's a slight advantage. So I do recommend you do a tuning procedure, and now whether you move the feed point further out from the tide, from the tower, which makes your apex angle a little bit sharper, or whether you make the dipole shorter or longer and do that impedance matching procedure of my article, or whether you use looting coils plus the impedance matching procedure in order to make things mechanically turn out right, those are the choices you've got. In order for his phasing system to work correctly, you are trying to get the exact same phase centers of radiation of each of the dipoles. So if his apex was 45 feet out from the tower, there's a slight advantage if you also make your apex fall 45 feet out. If not, there's an additional phase matching adjustment you should do as a function of what angle you want to steer this array. I recommend you don't go there. If he's got the apex 45 feet out, by hook or by crook, make your apex 45 feet out from the tower. Center. Back to you, Barry.
Yeah, I agree. We don't want to reinvent the wheel here. I know. He says that the apexes will be 92 feet apart. This is just some little thing I've noticed from W7DD. If you do it his way. So, and they're not talking, I have to call the manufacturer of the phasing box, talk about the coax, but do that later. That's not terribly important. I'm guessing that your method of bringing the antennas into residence is more like a little miniature antenna tuner, like a coil and an inductor or something, out at each feed point. Am I correct on that?
Good guess, but no. It's slightly simpler than that, but you'll be way ahead of the game when you read the article.
Okay, which I will do immediately after this. Okay, so you believe this is not a crazy idea, and I'm I'm starting to work on it. What I'm going to do first is just what you said. I'm going to make one dipole, one whatever, invertedly, whatever it's called, get it tuned real good, and when I'm satisfied with that one, I'm going to make three more just like it.
You got it. And properly deployed or implemented, I think this thing can be a gangbuster.
Yeah, it ought to be a fun project for 75 meters. That's what I'm planning on doing. Back over to you, and that was a lot of help. I hope I didn't bore everybody to death, and to Wendy. Thank you, Dick.
Oh, this is our... Mel and I, our raison d'etre is antennas, antenna tuning, antenna performance, antenna increase in performance. This is two-thirds of the reason that the TechNet exists, because very few components in the ham radio shack are more misunderstood than antennas. Very few components are capable of a hell of a lot more performance when we get smart enough than antennas. And as you've heard tonight, the 120-year-old dipole and 120-year-old loop antenna, by way of the December issue of Antennas and Propagation Journal, just got a whole lot better in bandwidth with no sacrifice in performance. I'm kind of amazed by all that. By the same token, 3 years ago, I filed for a patent on a modified Yagi antenna. And since the Yagi was invented in 1928, and 78 years later, or 75 years later, I'm filing for a new patent on Yagis. At first I thought, boy, does that take chutzpah. I suddenly realized there's enough improvement in design to make it a new invention. And it got granted. I was amazed. K2KE1, it looks like we may not get to Smith charting tonight, Mel. Also, an explanation for what happened last week. I expected a whole bunch of relatives to visit me on December 25th. They piled into my house on December 24th. I thought it was Saturday. Boy, was I confused. 10 o'clock at night, I said, holy cow, what did I do? And I go tuning on 8.5, and there was no life. So you might tell me what happened. Boy, did I goof last week. K2KEY, on the TechNet.
Dick, I just want to know, before you turn it over to Mel, it's K2RIW at ARRL.org, is that correct?
Negative. First of all, the article itself is Whiskey Alpha 1, Mike Bravo Alpha .com, www.wa1mba.com. That's Dr. Tom, his website. The bottom of his website has got dipole matching, Yagi matching, something like that it says. And when you open it up, you'll find an article by K2LIW. If you're sending something to me, it's my call letters at arrl.net is probably the best one. Back to you, Barry.
Yeah, that's what it was. Okay, I wanted to send something to you. And I wanted to send you the picture of it from your size W7DD. That's the guy. Okay, so I'm going to look up the article, and I'll file that away. But getting something to you with RWKOW@ARL.net, not org. And I'll do that tonight, too. Back over to Mel, and to Wendy.
Okay, this is K2KEY. Yeah, Charlene sort of brought me up to speed. Okay, so. No, I didn't do much last week because I also had a little bit of activity, to say the least. So I actually checked in for a minute, didn't really stay because I did explain that a couple of things had come up because of dinner with, Christmas dinner with my daughter in New Jersey and all. About the Smith chart, before I get on to these antenna, I want to talk to you about this receiving antenna, really. That's really what I want to really talk about. So what he described, Barry, yes, I remember seeing it now. I remember how they use the antennas also as a guiding, to guide the cross beam in there on the tower. So I remember all that different application of W7DD. I remember seeing that. The Smith chart, really, what they were asking me is, because these are people studying for an associate degree in electrical chart that goes describe in detail, step by step, like I've been going through on tutelages for the last 6 weeks or so. In other words, each thing explains to us why and where that's what they're looking for. They can't seem to find that many of the periodicals or whatever there are. They touch upon it, but, you know, they don't go into a lot of the sections to know a lot before they apply it to the Smith chart. But what I want to do is ask you if you've got a minute about the 75 meters. He and I were on the other night, and I'll tell you what happened and last week, and then I'd like to describe the antenna and see what you...
I transmitted in the wrong place. Yeah, go right ahead, Mel. You got the horn.
Greetings, Mr. Leto.
Okay, roger. All right, so anyhow... The noise level on 75 meters was horrendous. The noise had gone somewhere upwards of 10 dB over F9 on a well-calibrated meter. And in fact, sometimes they even had a little problem hearing Barry, which is, of course, literally almost shouting distance from here. So I was looking into receiving loops. And it was I finally went through, a pile of stuff. And I finally found this guy had built a similar problem on 160 meters with foreign broadcasters. And he came up with this loop antenna, which is 20 feet in diameter. Now, I described how he built it, and then I'll tell you what I did to it. And he put it, added a motor to turn it. He had another motor to adjust the variable condenser on it, another one to bend it to do all kinds of manipulations he had. So he actually used a azimuth elevation, AZEL, as the device to turn this loop and also to tilt it. So the loop that he built was 20 feet in diameter. And how he built it, he took two pieces of bamboo and held them together in the middle with two clamps. And he stretched around the outer periphery a piece of RG59U. And as he explains it, if you, you have this cross. In other words, you make this cross if you looked at the cross, you'd say the bottom of the cross, let's say, looking at a baseball diamond, would be home foot base on the bottom. And then you put, at that point, a variable capacitor. Then he has the RG59U 20 feet of it going around. And at the opposite end, which would say home plate, that would be like second base, he just splits the shield. He breaks the shield open about an inch, leaving the center intact, comes back around third base, and then back home. At that point, he has a variable condenser, and he connects the two open ends of the coax cable to the center go to either side of variable condenser. He then connects the two shields that come together there. He solders them together, and they become go to the shield of the feed line to the receiver. The center of the feed line to the receiver goes to the other side of the variable condenser. Can you picture this as the receiving loop first, Dick? Over.
Yes, I can. So he's got a complete loop of coax cable, but the shield is broken at second base, but the shield is complete at home plate, as well as first base and third base. But the two center conductors at home plate, one is directly fed, the other one goes to a, let's call it a variable capacitor. A variable capacitor goes between the two center conductors at home plate. And I'm going to guess that one of those semiconductors, like the one going toward first base, is the one that's driven.
And I experimented with that, and I confirmed that this makes a difference. Now, this is for 160 meters. I made the loop, I redid the loop, and he explains that the loop has to be within 0.1 micro, no, 0.1 wavelength of the band in of interest. So I made one up. This 20 feet would be, you know, quite large, and I made one up, and mine came out to being 12 feet in diameter. And how I select that is because, as he explained, the problem of making these loops, you have to understand that the distributed capacitance of the coax cable is a, you know, comes into effect. In other words, you've got to know how many picofarads per foot your coax cable is, and then you have to, you know, compute it out. So in computing it out, I found that if I have on this particular cable, this RG59U, I use a Velvet 8241, 12 feet of it gave me 265 picofarads of distributed capacitance, and it was an inductance of 7.3 microhenry. You follow what's happening here, Dick? Over.
To some degree. There is one place, though, where you switch terms. For the first few transmissions, you talked about the total length of wire for the band of interest being 20 feet long. Then you said 20 feet in diameter, and your version of it was 12 feet in diameter. So you switched from circumference to diameter. You confused me a little bit. Back to you, Mel.
Sorry. No, this was for 160 meters. That was 20 feet of wire, 20 feet of coax. That was for 160. I'm talking about mine for 80 meters. I stretched 12 feet of wire around this cross. In other words, this is a cross, so it winds up 3 feet between home base to first base, 3 feet from first base to second base, 3 feet from second base to third base, and another 3 feet will stretch it back to home plate. Do you follow now? Over.
Yes. So you're ending up, he had 20 feet for 160. I'm a little confused as to why you're not using 10 feet for 80 meters. Half the frequency, you would think it would be half the, twice the frequency, half the wavelength, you would think it would be half the cable. I've seen people from time to time measure picofarads per foot of capacitance and make calculations with it. When it's a very, very short piece of cable, as a open circuited stub, and you're less than a couple of tenths of a wavelength, that sort of works. But the transmission line is first a transmission line, second a distributed capacitor. My piece of coax cable going out to my tower is 200 feet long. If I added up the capacitance in 200 feet of cable, I would come up with a huge number. As long as I've got 50 ohm cable terminated with 50 ohms, there ain't no capacitance. This antenna is using that wire, and the coax cable does have a break in the shield at second plate. But now, is that coax cable a transmission line or a distributed capacitor? The answer is yes to both. So I'm a little bit worried if you add up picofarad per foot, it could lead you astray. I haven't accepted that one yet. Back to you, Mel.
Why I'm bringing it up, because I'm just going by the theory of what was written in the the manual. If you have the antenna manual, you can, the ARRL manual, I found it's just a couple of pages on it. Let's see, what's edition was this one? This is the 19th edition, if you have it, Dick. First of all, would you happen to have that manual? Over.
I sure do, and it's at the salt mine. Sorry about that.
Chapter 5, page 23. Anyhow, as he explains, this is the constraints of building this kind of a loop antenna, that the total, in other words, if you have 7.3 microhenry of inductance measured, and you have 265 picofarad of distributed capacitance, it will resonate somewhere around the 80 meter band. And that's why you add that tuning condenser on the bottom, and that's how you peak the thing. I built this thing, and I got it in a ham shack. It sits on a tripod, and I find that if I turn it, oh, I can peak a station in and chuck the variable and all, and I can null out noise and everything. Well, I got it all, a lot of other things connected, but that's basically the antenna itself I was working with. I'll tell you later on about QRN squashes and all that other stuff I added on. But just with this thing, I can turn and I can get rid of noise, I can get rid of a lot of things, and I tell you, fine, I receive better on this thing, this indoor loop in the shack, than I do on the full wavelength loop outside, Dick, over.
Well, this is bi-directional, right?
Yeah, I guess you can call it functional. Yes, you can call it bi-directional, but what's nice about it, you can actually null the noise, and at the same time, by adjusting the variable capacitor, peak the signal, Dick, over.
I'm amazed that that's giving you more signal than your great big loop outdoors way high in the air. Were you listening to Barry when you got more, or were you listening to a DX station?
The time I talked to Barry, I didn't have this thing. This is what I built this thing for, because the noise level was 10 over 9 at times. With this loop and my noise squasher, my noise level goes down to S2. I could pick DX stations, our weak DX stations, and working them. They were quite amazed that I was, you know, able to work them. And using the one wavelength loop outside, the one old 260-72 feet of it, that's what I'm transmitting on. I'm receiving on this loop. I got a pair of stereo phones, so I got two receivers going. But I hooked it all to the column 70 at 584 because I'm running a kilowatt there on 75 meters and a loop in the shack, and I don't want to take a chance of high voltage being picked up by this loop in the shack and forcing it out, you know, into a receiver that has a solid-state front end. So, you know, the 75A4 column has a tube front end, so I figured it, you know, it would be safe to do it that way, Dick, over.
Impressive. Amazing. I'd love to know what's going on here. Obviously, we got to study this some more. When you talk to Barry, you are in a near vertical incident system, either system, cloud warmer type, and hopefully the ionosphere has a maximum usable frequency or critical frequency that is supporting 80 meters, and it reflects back down. Even though there's only a couple of miles between you and Barry, that ground wave signal is getting there with medium strength, but it's competing against a zillion dB of noise on the band. I mean, on 80 meters, the noise figure of an antenna looking at the horizon, I'm not sure, but it's probably 50 dB. And so, particularly at high noon when it's D-level absorption, D-layer absorption, communicating one town away is very difficult. My very first, was it 80 meter? I think it was the 80 meter CWQSO at 25 watts. I talked to a guy from Farmingdale, where I was, over the Amityville, one town away, and he wasn't very many dB above the noise. So a short range 80 meter or 160 meter QSOs have got some peculiar characteristics. But you were listening to a DX station, and the loop in the shack is picking up a better signal to noise ratio of the DX station than the loop up in the air. I'm going to guess the loop up in the air gave you a bigger S meter report. You got a smaller S meter report in the shack, but you got a better signal to noise ratio in the shack. Is that approximately true, Mel? Go ahead. And we got to wait for the beep.
You wouldn't be able to hear that DX station. I don't have any idea. Since the noise level was sitting at 10 over 9. So I would never hear that DX station that was coming in, maybe S3 or S4. Now, I want to get to the other part of this. I also, as I said, have the loop not only in a shack, it's on a tripod, so I'm able not only to turn it, I'm able to tilt the loop. And I find that now tilting the loop up and down, in other words, if you looked at this loop and you have this crossbar, it's mounted normally vertically on the tripod. But on the tripod, I can loosen, you know, the handle that, of course, you adjust for the, you know, camera angle. And I can tilt the loop so that between, in other words, if the loop is mounted on a tripod at the home base where the variable is and all, and you connect your wire to your receiver and everything, all done down there on the bottom. If I then tilt this thing is sitting like that, if I tilt this thing so that second base is starting now to lean from the vertical towards the horizontal, somewhere in between, I many times get better signals. It seems like a Faraday rotation or whatever, but I can actually see the difference in the angle, Dick, over.
Yeah. Where you started off with the description of home plate, first base, second base, third place, back to home plate, I assume the starting position of the loop is that the plane of the loop is parallel to the ground. That's what I assume. And then when you tilt it, second base is either tilting down lower than the home plate or higher than the home plate. Or possibly you make third base higher than first base. That's kind of tilting. Or did you start off with the plane of the antenna perpendicular to the ground? So the starting position is not yet clear. Not yet clear to me.
Exactly. With the coax stretched around the outer periphery, and the variable condensed and everything is at home plate. In other words, it starts out in the vertical plane, the whole work. You now turn this thing, and you get the signal. Well, you get a comfortable, point where you got a comfortable noise level and signal level. In other words, you can nudge it a little bit. It's pretty critical. So it makes a heck of a difference. You now turn the variable condenser and you peak the signal. You now take this loop and you start to lean it from the vertical position towards the horizontal, and that's when you also see a difference, over.
Okay, so I'm hearing you on the input very well, so don't worry. Once again, did you start off with the loop parallel to the ground? You keep saying I started off vertical. I'm a little bit confused by that. Back to you, Mel.
Start off with it mounted on the tripod with the pole straight up. Between home base and second base, it was standing straight up like a vertical. And the crossbar right across it, in other words, it's standing like you would stand. That's why I say, if you had the manual, you could see a picture of it, the 160-meter one that he had. And in other words, it's standing straight up, Dick. Between home base and second base is completely vertical when you start out, over.
Okay, I see that. And then how far did you tilt it when you peaked up the signal?
This is the point. Sometimes I'm tilting it almost horizontal. I'm going down now almost to the horizontal plane, like the loop outside, the one-way plane loop. Other times I'm picking it up. I'm going 60 degrees, 50 degrees, 90 degrees, 80 degrees, back and forth. And different signals, and in fact, with the stereo phones on, one earphone is on the one receiver that's connected to the outside loop, and the other stereo phone is on the Collins 7584 with the inside receiving loop. There are times I can hear it when the noise level is reasonable. I can hear the signal going like rising and falling from one earphone to another. It's a strange effect, almost sometimes even a delay in the signal, like a sort of like a propagation delay, Dick, over.
I got something to add to this, Dick.
Yeah, there's a couple of things going on. Get you in a second, Barry. And that is, because you're using two individual receivers, and those two receivers do not have a phase-locked LO, minor differences in the tuning of the local oscillator of the two receivers, if you're listening to a sideband signal, with stereo headphones, will give you some peculiar drifting effects. On top of that, you are getting the usual changes in the ionosphere. And so, which effect dominates? Beautiful. A lot of experimenting. If this is the best of all worlds, there would be one common local oscillator feeding both receivers. A couple of comments on that. Go you first, Mel, then pass it over to Barry, T2LAW.
Okay, well, at times, it's perfect. You can't tell the difference. I can turn one volume up, the other one down. There's no difference. Everything falls perfectly in. It's only sometimes it's actually in the atmosphere something is happening when you start to hear this effect. It's not the receivers. because, like I say, at times everything sounds so perfect. There's nothing that it balances itself out so perfect that it's amazing. Now, the only thing that I was curious about, because I guess this is what I was talking about, the distributed capacitance of coax. If I took it to another coax and I used one that had a lower picofarad per foot, that way I could make the loop somewhat larger. Would it be an improvement, would you believe? Yes or no? Because you got to read really the article, that the constraints of the loop he explains here must be within less than 0.1 wavelength. This one here is, let's see, I computed out the 0.045 wavelength on 80 meters, on 75 meters. He said you must stay within less than 0.1 wavelength. And because I measured everything, and it does work, it does peak, everything is working properly according to what's supposed to happen, according to the article. But I was curious, what happens if I went to a table that had a distributed capacitance of less per foot? Do you have any ideas, over?
Yeah, I see where you're going. Let me read a trap. I think the bigger diameter loop in itself would not work better. That's my belief. When you're building a loop-type antenna, as some guys do for 100 kilohertz reception and 500 kilohertz reception type stuff, the loop resonating and having the right plane of resonance is what counts, because it's an H-field antenna. By the same token, the ferrite loop you've got in that portable AM radio, you don't worry about the diameter of that loop. Whole antenna with a ferrite rod just picks up the presence of the H field going by and applies it to the first stage of amplification. For the most part, it is not a kind of antenna that is trying to absorb significant energy out of that wave that goes by. It's just sensing the presence of the E field, or in the case of a small rip on your automobile, it's sensing the presence of the H field without really sucking power out of it. So I don't think diameter is an advantage. Now, that's my belief. It's a different kind of antenna. Effective capture area is a function of the resonance. When you build an 80-meter dipole, the wire itself casts a shadow on the ground that's a couple of square inches. But the 80-meter dipole, when resonated, has an effective capture area of 8,500 feet. You could, if you want to, decide, I'm going to do something to the 80-meter dipole by putting loading capacitors or whatever, so I'm going to make it a little bit longer than the normal 130 feet, and I'm going to pick up a whole lot of extra gain. Doesn't happen that way. So to fight for a different impedance of cable to make the loop larger, hoping to pick up more performance, I'm doubtful. Not positive, but I'm doubtful. N2MB, K2LIW. Go ahead, Barry.
One more thing. Barry and I were on at 1 o'clock in the morning, Dick, so it wasn't, daytime conditions, over.
Understand. Go ahead, Barry. And I'm going to have to leave you guys in about 5 minutes.
Okay, yeah. We had one, you and I actually had this discussion about 15 years ago. I added something to that loop that I thought might be of interest to know. If you had a second loop and you phased them properly, wouldn't this thing, I don't know how far apart you'd have to put them. Might have to put the thing outside. But I think there's a way to do this and actually have one direction for this loop instead of two.
When it comes to the section on direction finding antennas with a loop, there's a way where you put a monopole in the middle of the loop and properly phase them together, and you end up with a cordioid pattern instead of a donut pattern. So you can make a direction-finding antenna significantly favor one direction over the other. So all loop antennas you can do that with. Back to you, Barry, and then pass it over to Mel.
Yeah, that's why I brought it up, because I thought that Mel should know about that. Maybe, you know, he should incorporate that into his design. I think it would be a big help. Over to you, Mel.
I have a whole group RDF antenna system that has a ferrite rod, and a vertical sitting on there, and you adjust it, and basically that's how you set it up so you can tell the direction, in other words, so you don't have this situation of bidirectional. But this receiving loop is, according to this article, this is what you should look for because it gives you this nulling effect, and at the same time, it, many times you see it, it does something strange when you start tilting it all. You null and you peak, and then you can adjust the variable condenser, which is between 10 and goes from 10 to 250 microfarads. And it's amazing. You know, you can actually, by adjusting the, even the variable, you can actually bring the noise even further down. If you've got a signal that can that you can reduce a little bit, you can bring the noise level literally down to zero. I just, you never expected the result that I got with this, Harry. I'm flabbergasted at what is taking place here. So, Dick, if you get a chance, take a look in the book on the receiving loop for 1.8 megs and see what you think of.
Yeah, Chapter 5, page 23 of the 19th edition. Out of curiosity, what made you decide to build that antenna? And I think you said you built it, yes, for 160 meters. What made you decide to build that, Mel?
This is one for 80. I didn't build the one for 160. This is the article for 160. I tried to, well, we were on here with my friend in Pennsylvania. I couldn't copy him. The noise level was phenomenal. After I built this thing, this past week we had a number of contacts with him in Pennsylvania, and I got perfect copy on him. He says he gets good copy on me on the transmitting loop, but I, as far as receiving, I couldn't receive him with all that noise. Now with this receiving loop, I can get perfect copy, 100%. We were on the other night, it was 100%. I tried the QRN squasher. So what I did is I got this receiving loop also feeding the QRN squasher on top of it, and I'm using that through a Wilkinson hybrid divider. The whole contraption of wires and cables going back and forth, but I'm amazed that I can take noise level from 10 over 9 and bring it down to S2 over.
Impressive. When you're using the outside loop antenna and you're getting a whole lot of noise and you're getting very poor copy with your buddy in Pennsylvania, what kind of noise and what kind of copy is he getting? Both of you running the same watt? Back to you, Mel.
Yeah, he's running kilowatt there also. He's up in the mountains, so he hasn't got too much, you know, man-made noise. With all these lights, Christmas lights and things around flashing away and all kinds of stuff, I don't know what kind of grinding noises and you name it, all kinds of crazy noises have been showing up, and seems to be constant. Now also occasionally on the loop, the regular loop, I hear off noise that I guess is being generated maybe by lightning somewhere off there, because you can hear that crackle coming and going, and yet if it doesn't seem to show up as prevalent on the receiving loop, Dick. Over.
Impressive. Are you using a receiver that has a known good noise blanker, Mel?
Yeah. No, that Collins 75A4 receiver, that poor receiver, what I've done to it already. Yeah, it's got, you know, mechanical filters and all the other contraptions. I always say someday someone will get that receiver when I'm up in the great DX land, and they're going to say, what the heck has this guy had in mind that he's got all these different connectors going into this receiver at different parts? But in this way, I was able to split the front end apart if I wanted. I can, you know, work on, you know, connect into the IF strips at different points in certain filters. And, you know, I've done all kinds of things with it. An easy receiver to work on because, you know, it's an old big piece of equipment. Bottom comes off. Everything's exposed on both top and bottom. Over.
Well done. I'm going to have to start signing off with you guys, and so you'll have to carry on. Barry, I'll turn it over to you for a semifinal with me, and you and Mel can continue. And do have me, KQRIW.
Okay, real good. While I'm talking to you, I'm trying to fix the computer, and I've got to tell you, that's frustrating. Okay, I tried to get to, maybe I've got the wrong call, it's WA1MBA, Mike Bravo Alpha.com.
But it comes up no good. So am I getting the call letters wrong?
Stand by, I'll go there right now.
You were saying that you were looking for a 75-meter way of talking to somebody out, I think, in Smithtown. Is that correct? Over.
You're talking an email? Yes. Yeah. Exactly.
This is the WQEL repeater.
Oh, Barry, maybe that's your antenna to maybe to... you to talk to Smithtown. You know, maybe you're looking for something maybe that would work better as some kind of a transmitting receiving loop. Maybe the answer to your situation, over.
It's WA1MBA.org. I got it wrong. It's .org.
Okay, that's probably the only one I didn't try. WA1MikeBravoAlpha.org. Organization. Okay, I just didn't try that one. I figured it wouldn't be in order. How long I can be. Over to you, Dick.
Yeah, you'll see him at the bottom of his website. Have a nice New Year. Bye-bye, you all. I can make the two charts show up, but my article, I'm having trouble making it show up.
I will leave for next week. We'll discuss loops and things. If you get a chance, you'll look in the manual, the 19th edition, and see what you think about all this jazz, and we can take it from there. What I had asked earlier, because people were looking for spin shots with, you know, each individual idea of a problem to discuss it and step by step how will I determine, you know, to figure out the problem. That's what they're looking for, one particular manual, but I have never seen one that, you know, goes step by step like I would. Good night, and Barry. Have you done anything on 80 meters with the straight key night tonight? Over.
No, I didn't even know it was tonight. But I do want you to know that your last contact with this fellow down in, I think it's Pennsylvania or something, I didn't get a chance to break in, but I was eavesdropping. And I might say that reception of you was much better last night, I think it was last night, than the first time I did this with you.